Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by High-Tech Answers and Healthcare Now Radio, part of the Answers Media Network, and is sponsored by the Law Offices of Myrick O'Connell. Now here is your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Paul Meyer, Market President, Public and Community at WellPass. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks for being here.
So kind of before we dive into the main part of our conversation, can you give everyone a little bit of a background as to who you are and what you do?
Sure. Well, I'm new to WellTalk. I actually, WellTalk just acquired my company called WellPass. Before that, I built a company called Voxiva that became WellPass. So I've really been last 15 or 17 years been working to implement interactive health messaging programs focused on improving health outcomes.
So kind of before we dive into maybe unpacking what those interactive tools are and what that means, what initially brought you into the healthcare space?
Oh, it was a long and winding path. let's see, I started in politics. I worked on Bill Clinton's first campaign, was one of his speechwriters at the White House, then went to law school, then started doing humanitarian work and using technology to help reunify refugees and refugee crises. Then I was in Kosovo when the war ended and had an idea to build what began as a wireless internet provider and then became the mobile phone company. And then I realized that mobile phones were spreading around the world, especially in developing countries, and that you could do more than make phone calls with them. And my mother had been a public health person for years, and I was starting to think about, well, how do you really use this sort of growing spread of cell phones in developing countries to put them to good use? And she sort of brought the health perspective and said, hey, you know, there's this problem with rural health workers using reporting outbreaks of disease. What if we use cell phones to make that better? And so started the company, and our first services 17 years ago were a system to allow rural health workers to use cell phones to key in data about, you know, how many cases of cholera in my village. And we basically are aggregating that in through an automated system and providing real-time mapping and visualization of disease outbreaks in the Amazon basin of Peru. So that's how it began, and then ended up, you know, rolling out similar systems focused on public health. Mobile phone-based systems for public health in about 17 countries. And then about 10 years ago, shifted my energy and attention to the U.S. And started, I think, we really the sort of the pioneers of again, using cell phones to deploy services that improve health outcomes.
So kind of thinking about that path that you were just describing, as you said, kind of focusing a lot internationally before, I think you said about 10 years ago, turning internally to the U.S. in terms of using, you know, cell phones or mobile phones to help with those connections. Does that suggest that the U.S. is behind in how it's utilizing mobile technology in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you want to look historically, I think one of the reasons there was so much innovation in developing countries is because cell phones were the only, you know, there was no landline infrastructure. You know, there were no computers. I mean, cell phone really was the first sort of point of connection to a lot of the world. And so so I think in terms of leveraging mobile devices, there was a lot of, out of necessity, a lot of innovation in the rest of the world because cell phones were the only thing, the only game in town.
Right. And that really just seems to echo, you know, comments that you hear all over the place now. You know, I was at a conference recently, and you know, you heard the now common line of everyone, you know, pointing to their pocket of everyone has this incredibly powerful computing device in their pocket, and we're not fully utilizing its capabilities for connection.
Absolutely. I think the other thing that's really interesting, you know, and in some ways, I mean, this is more not just for technologically based, but in some ways, think about the business model of healthcare. I think one of the other, and this is for me one of the great things that's so exciting and promising about the potential of mobile and digital services. One of the other things that, you know, in a very resource-constrained environment, like, you know, developing countries, you have to figure out how to provide services at a radically low cost, right? Because there just isn't very much money. I think one of the challenges of our healthcare system is it's so expensive. You know, we spend $3.5 trillion in healthcare here. And our starting position is this really expensive system that pays for expensive things. And I think oftentimes people, the existing healthcare system has started to think about, all right, how do we add digital to what we do? And I actually think what's much more interesting is, like, how could we start with digital? Because digital has an advantage that there's virtually zero marginal cost to it. So if rather, I guess here's another analogy. Let's go, let's think about the old book industry. Like, if you think to yourself, back 25 years and you're Barnes and Noble, you think you're like, hey, we're a bookstore. Let's put up a website so we can maybe do some online selling, versus obviously Amazon was sort of digital first and really disrupted the model with a digital first strategy. And so I think healthcare is sort of an interesting kind of, conundrum, just in the sense of, is the model, add some digital capabilities to existing delivery models, or can you actually kind of reimagine what a healthcare delivery model looks like if you start digital? And I think thinking about solving problems in very resource poor constrained settings like the developing world is an interesting way to sort of come up with kind of radically different models for thinking about how to solve some of these problems.
And I have a feeling you're going to anticipate this coming question, but what would it mean, thinking in the U.S., to have a digital-first model implemented? How would that go about changing the system?
Well, let me just give you an example from my experience. So 8.5 years ago, we launched a service called Text for Baby. And I give you a little bit of the backstory of how we launched that. When about 10 years ago, when I was beginning to turn my attention here, I was going around talking to health plans and health systems and public health people about my vision of cell phones as untapped health behavior change devices. And everyone's reaction was, oh, that makes so much sense. Let's definitely get together next quarter. Or we just couldn't get anybody to start. So I sort of said, well, what can we do just to show what this is all about? So came up with this idea that became Text for Baby. And I described it at the time as the SMS version of what to expect when you're expecting. It's a free service. It's still available. We've enrolled over 1.5 million pregnant women and new moms in it. And you just, you sign yourself up by texting the word baby to 511411. And we ask you your due date and your zip code. And you're enrolled in what's a personalized, interactive support and education program. When we launched it, I was able to convince all the mobile phone companies to make it free. We collaborated with CDC, with CMS, with the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, with the American Academy of Pediatrics, developed the content. We worked with just about every health plan, every hospital system, state health departments, and launched it with the White House, and it has become a pretty ubiquitous free support service for pregnant women and new moms. What's interesting about it, it also is effective. So we've published a number of peer-reviewed clinical studies demonstrating its efficacy for doing things like increasing well baby visit attendance, doubling flu shot utilization. So actually demonstrating this basically zero marginal cost digital intervention drives clinical outcomes. We've done the same thing in smoking cessation, a program that we launched 6 or 7 years ago called Text to Quit, which again has been demonstrated. This is a purely automated text-based program to support smoking cessation. We published a study in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine demonstrating that Text to Quit doubled smoking cessation rates. So in diabetes, a program that we developed with the American Diabetes Association called Care for Life, again, in a published clinical study, demonstrated that we've actually been able to reduce HbA1c by 1.3 points, which is huge. It's about the kind of the outcome you get from a medication in terms of its impact on diabetes. And so you think about it, like these are purely automated, interactive, you know, texting programs basically, but have the same efficacy that medicines have or that, you know, telephone-based counseling has, but just at a radically lower cost. So those are kind of examples of what I think are kind of, you know, sort of radically low-cost services that, you know, are, you know, in the Intexor Baby case, available for free, but actually are, you know, deliver clinical outcomes. Now, you know, Intexor Baby is not going to deliver your baby for you, but it's, you know, it's effectively providing effective, proven education and support that's driving clinical outcomes at a, you know, radically low cost and radically accessible way.
Right, because as you're kind of saying, it's, and I don't think you were suggesting it at any point, it's not trying to substitute for other necessary care, but to improve the means by which that other care is delivered, or how you, or you know, the progression from one point to the next within the more traditional delivery of, you know, care when you're face to face with somebody.
Absolutely. And the way I think about it is what you do is you let the care delivery system practice at the top of their licensure, right? And then to give you an analogy, you know, 15 years ago when we were doing disease surveillance in places like Peru, in India and Rwanda, one of the things, so put yourself, imagine you're a head of epidemiology for Peru, right? Usually, you know, you're relying on pieces of paper, paper reports to find out when there was cholera where, right? And so, and it would take weeks for these pieces of paper to filter in. So you basically didn't really know what the problems were in the country. And so you were effectively kind of flying blind. And so oftentimes people would just sort of ride circuit and go visit clinics and sort of, you know, see what was happening. Now, you know, imagine, but I mean, based on this kind of systems we implemented, you're now getting a real-time feed of reports from every clinic in the country. How many cases of cholera in my village? So you look at that and you say, oh, look, this clinic reported zero cases. I don't have to think about them. You focus your energy on the clinics that say, hey, we have three cases of cholera, or the clinics that don't report. So what it does, it allows you then to spend your time and energy in the places that you have problems. Now think about, you know, take that now to maternity. Intexor Baby is providing, you know, free, you know, universal baseline level of education, coaching, support, but also triage. Intexor Baby asks questions like, have you had a prior preterm birth? That's a big risk factor for another preterm birth. So if you think about, you know, that these kinds of digital services is almost like first line sort of education support, but also triage, you can then basically refer people up into higher levels of support and then allow your, you know, hire your trained healthcare providers to focus on the people that actually really need their help, you know, and again, focus on practicing at the top of their licensure. Does that make sense?
No, certainly. It definitely does. And for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Paul Meyer from WellPass, now a part of WellTalk. And we've been talking about the use of digital tools. And Paul, kind of a lot of the examples you've been talking about that you've worked on are all based around different forms of communication. So kind of picking up on the theme of communication, what do you see as the most effective means of communicating in what is largely a digital world now?
Look, we've spent, you know, many years focusing on text messaging as a primary channel of communication. And although it's all, just to be clear, our programs are automated, right? So this is still primarily automated-based interaction, but delivered by text messaging. And there's a reason that I really believe texting is such a powerful tool. If you think about it, you know, texting is primarily used as a tool for communicating with a person, right? From your family or friends. If you're using an app, if you're looking at a website, deep down you know it's a computer somewhere. But when you get a text, it pushes a button in your brain. Oh, wait, this is the kind of message I get from a person. So the reason that I think we've sort of believed it's so powerful and been able to demonstrate the efficacy of this tool and this channel is because it registers and resonates with people as, you know, even when it's being generated by a machine, by a computer, it registers in the brain as if it's a message coming from person. So I think it connects. Messaging is messaging, and it doesn't have to be just by text, by a chat bot and so forth. It registers as a message that's being sent by a person rather than something that we in our brains deep down know is a machine. And so I think that's why certainly I think we've believed and been able to show the kinds of results and efficacy that we have, because it pushes a different button in our brain than, you know, some other channels of communication.
No, and I think that's a very insightful observation, because you're right. It's, you know, you see these tools that are all over the internet now, I think. And, you know, my suspicion is probably 90%+ of the time, everyone assumes that there's another human on the other end of that connection typing in the message. But that's probably not the case in the majority of instances nowadays.
Correct.
So kind of with that shift, you know, where are, you know, beyond the areas that you've already worked on within healthcare, where do you see are some of the areas of greatest opportunity to, you know, adopt a more digital-based or foundationally digital interaction?
Well, where we spend, you know, our time and energy on, and I'm, you know, most personally passionate about, is in Medicaid, and in some ways in sort of the lowest resource part of our healthcare system. Again, because I think they're the lowest resources. And I think, you know, where you, just like, you know, my earlier work in the developing world, you know, if you look at Medicaid, you know, the resources are limited. Access to care is a real problem. And so in terms of thinking about our, you know, so that's the sort of the part of the system that I'm, you know, most personally passionate about, just because I think there are real opportunities to implement really innovative new models that address what's a really key challenge in terms of providing access to care for our lower income people in this country.
Yeah, and I think, as you said, it's, you know, taking advantage of the resources that are there, because it's, you know, even though there are certainly challenged populations there, there are still these, you know, these means of connection that exist, because they, you know, so many, you know, even in those areas, the individuals are still extremely likely to have a phone or other means of accessing. So it's, you know, it really sounds like it's, you know, just thinking about who you're trying to serve and then figuring out a way to go out and meet them, as opposed to expecting them to come to you.
Absolutely. And look, I mean, if you look at the data, lower income people actually over-index on, for example, smartphones, because for the most part, they don't have laptops, they don't have computers at home. And for Medicaid plans, and most of our clients and partners that we work with are Medicaid health plans, you know, they really struggle. You know, they spend huge amounts of money on direct mail, even though, you know, they don't have reliable addresses and have huge, you know, incredible levels of, you know, return mail for bad addresses. So they can't use direct mail. People aren't really, you know, don't have computers or PCs in their home. Cell phones, you know, are the primary way of being able to, you know, engage and interact with folks. And so we've really focused our energies on figuring out ways to leverage the fact that this is the primary communication channel for folks, and put it to use to really improve outcomes. And you know, we're pretty proud to have been able to demonstrate that we have actually been able to do it and show results, you know, at the same standards that new medicines or new treatments are subject to, kind of peer randomized control studies published in peer reviewed journals.
And thinking about that line of discussion, it's, you know, obviously it sounds like you're trying to do a lot to convince the providers to use, to implement these tools. And, you know, as you said, you're backing up with a lot of data, but I think there's kind of, you know, one of those common sayings is, you know, medicine is extremely slow to change and adopt anything new. So what are some of the biggest barriers that you encounter when you're trying to convince the, you know, the industry side of healthcare, so like the providers or the insurers, to follow your suggestions?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that take those in sort of two parts. In terms of providers, where we've been, I think, most effective is, providers like evidence. They're doctors. They practice evidence-based medicine. So, it's pretty powerful when we can say, hey, look, we think you should tell your pregnant women about Texture Baby, or here's a program to help your, people with diabetes, and here's the published study showing that it actually works. So having that evidence of clinical outcomes is very powerful in terms of convincing providers that these are services that they should not only feel comfortable, but want to promote to their patients. Now, you don't get me started in some of the challenges of integrating into workflows and EHRs and all the rest. I don't think we have time enough on this podcast to get into that wonderful morass of complexity. But I think the other things that have been interesting, and I think we did this in a really innovative way with Texture Baby, is really thinking about how to work with different stakeholders around common goals. So if I think about a service like Texture Baby, one of the things, first and foremost, it works for mom and, meets her needs and is a supportive service that, we're, again, proud to be able to say works and delivers results. But if you then think about it, it's one common service that actually has multiple value propositions for multiple stakeholders. So you asked about the providers. Well, obviously providers, want better outcomes for their patients, but they also want people to show up for visits. So, one of the things Texture Baby does is says, hey, don't forget, Johnny's almost 2 months old. Have you scheduled the well baby visit? Did you go? And so it's driving increase in visit attendance, which providers care about. Guess what? Our Medicaid health plan customers and partners are very keen on showing that they can achieve quality metrics. And so one of the key metrics that many of them are incented under their contracts to achieve are improving well baby visit attendance rates and vaccination rates. And so guess what? They love it because it's good for their members, but also it helps them achieve their quality goals. We have a great partnership with Pfizer, who make Prevnar, which is one of the big pneumococcal vaccines that is indicated at 2, 4, 6, and 12 months. Well, baby visits. Guess what? They, it's very much in their interest to get babies to show up at 2, 4, 6, and 12 month well baby visits because they get vaccinated. So it's in some ways, as you think about these, I think really interesting opportunities where you can effectively provide one shared service, but it works for the person most importantly, but it also from a provider perspective, it works for, helps them achieve their goals. From the payer's perspective, it helps them achieve their goals. And that's, that's, I think, a wonderful model. It's not easy to pull off, but it's pretty powerful when you can actually bring multiple stakeholders and bring them align around sort of common purpose because ultimately their separate goals are very largely overlapping and they can get behind a service that ultimately drives better outcomes.
Right. And kind of, one piece of it that you dance around a little bit, and I certainly appreciate that it will take up a lot of time, but I don't know if you can give the high level detail of, how does the messaging, I think it's somewhat clear in terms of how the messaging goes out to the patient, but then how do the responses or the action items get processed on the provider side of things?
Well, look, our services fundamentally are, run. We operate these services on our platform and run them, and they run automatically, and they're fully automated. Now, when we're working with a provider system or with a payer system, ultimately, we're of course then providing data back, right? So if you want to think about it, they run on autopilot because it's all based on the clinical guidelines and the algorithms that drive the interactive medicine programs. But then if we're plugged into, for example, a health plan that we're working with, they're getting access to the data of which of my members got enrolled, what were their responses, what were the interactions, and we're able to report that back to, for example, our health plan partners for them to be able to analyze that data to obviously understand the reach and impact of the programs and services, but also to potentially intervene or escalate where they need to.
Yeah, no, and I think kind of as you're saying, you know, it's just a high volume of interaction and information to be able to pull back and be able to act upon. But as we're already starting to extremely quickly come up on the end of our time, I'm going to take a pivot point and present, you know, ask one final question that is going to, you know, hopefully let you kind of, I don't know if it'd be looking to a crystal ball or just, you know, what an ideal world would be for you. But, you know, if you were in charge, what change would you make to the healthcare system?
We have how many 3 hours left?
I will. How about the 60 second thumbnail sketch?
So let me. Hard to answer the whole thing, but let me give you one sort of perspective that I'd sort of leave you with. I came out of the world of public health and worked with CDC and many public health partners and still do. And I think one of the interesting things that we have yet to figure out as a country is the way I think about it is public health, you know, cared about everybody and has no money. And then, you know, traditionally we had a $3 trillion healthcare system billing for doctor visits. Again, I'm obviously oversimplifying. We've now started to change the payment models and incentives so that payers and providers and others are beginning to be financially incented around population health outcomes. But what's often happening is they're approaching it just through their own lens. And when you actually think about the fragmentation of our system and people change providers, they change payers, they change jobs, and it becomes very hard to really deploy services that support people over the course of their lives. And so the thing I think we need to still do a lot of work on, I think there's a real interesting opportunity, is to really think about the sort of intersection between what I think of as public health, services that ought to be available for everybody, and what we're calling population health, services that are being provided through a payer, a provider, so forth. So I think there's a lot of work to do and really interesting opportunity in thinking about what's that right interplay between public health and many of the population health interventions and programs that are being deployed through, you know, many of the stakeholders in the system.
All right, well, thank you for that very thoughtful and hopeful final thought or final statement. But kind of as I already suggested, believe it or not, we are out of time. I want to thank my guest, Paul Meyer, for a great conversation today.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at hashtag HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.